hello. Didn't see you there. You'll have come about the Culture File Weekly. Well, I have that here for you now. Of course it's not the same stuff you got last time. This is the new stuff. So this time, with the Day of the Dead just behind us, we're off to visit, photographically, cemeteries in Oaxaca and County Cork, and from there it's out onto the streets of Kinsale in search of colour. Then avant-ventriloquist Nina Conti introduces us to her inner voices, and finally we wonder why playwright and Labour activist Eva Gore Booth is so little celebrated. But before all that, we enter the Octagon. Happily not the cage where Conor McGregor meets his UFC opponents, but the slightly less perilous, you might think, headquarters of the Irish Georgian Society. But it turns out to be a hair-raising encounter nonetheless. Inside, it's full of graves. We cornered photographer Alejandro Gomez de Tudo and curator Jean-Philippe Bambert, who are behind a new exhibition, Cometerion 1, which photographically forges the link between Balanspittel and Oaxaca, among other cemeteries in Mexico and in Ireland.
Come in.
So my name is Jean-Philippe Imbert, and I lecture in comparative literature at DCU. And I'm just acting here as curator for Alejandro, who has come from Mexico yesterday for this exhibition.
I'm Alejandro Gomez de Tudo. I do visual arts, and I am for my second time in Dublin, for an exhibition invited by the DCU and Jean-Philippe, this time in the Irish Georgian Society, to make an installation and a photographic exhibition called Cometerion 1, or K1, which is the first of a series of photographs and installations of cemeteries around the world. The name of the installation is Hash Behisht, which means in Persian the Eight Paradises.
So basically the idea was to bring over to Ireland somebody travelling around to have a look at the different receptacles of death in life, to have a view at somebody who brings in different art forms to express that, and to see how an Irish audience would react to this one. Because of course there was the easy way of doing plain Mexican funerary art photographs or plain Irish funerary arts photographs, because we're dealing with cultures that celebrate death quite a lot. But this is not about that.
And actually, that's important to mention, because the whole project of Cometerion, this is K1, will be presented as a mirror. So this very first one, K1, is about Ireland and Mexico. So we chose these two countries to be the first to start in this. The octagon in architecture starts with the Lighthouse of Alexandria, and then with the Tower of Winds in Greece, and so on. But I'm very glad that there is such a nice octagon in the middle of downtown Dublin.
And I also think that, architecturally speaking, the Georgian Society was using octagons probably for different ends. It was a way of encompassing space, of generating safety with some sort of sacred behind it. And now we're trying
ritual.
To... And rituals as well. So we're trying to give freedom back to the octagon in the same way that the Irish Georgian Society is regenerating some sort of freedom to Georgian culture, which had suffered quite a lot, understandably enough.
And also this octagon shape has the perfect form in which there's a center, and since it's two squares that are moved, then it spreads to the cardinal points. So it's whenever there was a society, a compound of people thinking or having certain ideas that were developing, the octagonal shape is a perfect one to spread and to keep secret. Mainly, the criteria of choosing the Irish images and the Mexican images, it was difficult. So you will see that the Irish images are more about space. So they are like, if you can see that pyramid by the sea, or the road there, and if you realize the Mexican photographs are more about details. So it's also this double point of view of the cemeteries, like a broad look of the space, and a sharp look of the space.
Is it meaning about death or is it meaning about
no,
life?
No, and also there's another another aspect about cemeteries. There's a place where you can still find a track of a culture of the last 200 years or 300 years sometimes, or even more in exceptional cases. Most of the contemporary cities have been completely transformed, and they have been destroyed and rebuilt. And in the cemeteries, you can still find a track of the imaginary of the people that lived in that same area. I think Mexico and Ireland, they're both very similar cultures in this aspect. I mean, we don't take that seriously, death. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if we really, really care for it, we have this spirit of exorcism through taking death as something not that solemn.
This one, we were in Puebla, Alejandro and I, and this was actually the first graveyard we went to, because we were there for the weekend, and that is the first grave we saw. That's James Sheehy, who was born in Ireland in 1857, but died in Mexico in 1903. Do you remember?
Yes, we found in two cemeteries in Mexico some Irish that were born in Ireland and then died in Mexico. So these first photographs is about James that was born on the 24th of June of 1857 and died on the 24th of June of 1903. So we found in Puebla there's a community of Irish people. So we found O'Dogherty's, we found
O'Flaherty's, Sheehy's,
O'Farrell's
as well.
Many Irish names. So this is
was probably one of the first ones. Do you remember?
That we found, yes.
Jean-Philippe Bambert and Alejandro Gomez de Tudo there on their exhibition Cometerion 1 in the Octagon Room at the Irish Georgian Society, which is in South William Street in Dublin. Colour, wrote Joseph Albers, deceives continually. You never see what really is, especially when it comes to the colour of shadows. Artist and colour theorist Catherine Boucher-Berg forages for colour in the lanes of Kinsale, observing the neon green of newly unfurled ferns, the satisfaction given by a purple foxglove, and the very dark blue that can only be found hiding behind barn doors. Eleanor Flegg tagged along on a journey into colour.
This is a particularly ordinary looking bit of ditch, but you've seen mad passed me by.
This is a particular incidence of something people talk about quite a lot in colour, and that is cold and warm. So we have a new bramble coming out here with bramble buds that are about to bloom, but they're not out yet. The colour of the buds that are about to bloom on this bramble are very cold and very light green. So you'd have a very white green, but cooler, and then you'd have the new bramble leaves, which are very much in contrast because they're, again, new bramble leaves, which have a lot of yellow in them, and then that's at the end of the bramble, whereas further down the bramble you've got the older spotted bramble leaves that have come through the wind and the cold spring. And then they see now here, there's another example of complementary colours. Do you see the spots on the old bramble leaves? That reddish brown is very much the complementary colour of the old bramble green. I think of colour as a language. And just as if you read a book, you might pick up some new words and you would say, I'd like to do something with that word or whatever. I constantly look into the landscape and am picking up words, which are colours, and then thinking, okay, naming them.
We're kind of on a shopping trip for colours.
Exactly. Yes. And remembering them by naming them, because once you've named them or thought, okay, this is how I'd mix this colour, you're more apt to remember it.
Could you go home and paint those colours?
Yes, because it's training. It's like someone who can hear a tune and go home and play it on their fiddle. And if they've been doing that for years, they can remember longer and longer phrases, because I practically on a daily basis make note of colour combinations that are useful or interesting or beautiful to me, then I have ways of remembering them. Okay, we've stopped here in a road that is very overgrown in the middle with grass, and but there's something nice to observe here, and that is if you look to the right, you're looking into the sun, and this very fluffy, soft inner road looks very yellow-green, and the light is picking up all the yellow because the light is also coming through the grasses. Whereas if you look to the left, it looks completely different green. It's a much colder, bluer green because the light is coming from the back and we're going away from the light. And then what you can also see from here, and even though the sun isn't that bright, the shadows that are being thrown over this fluffy green are bluer and darker. If you've learned to really observe the colours of shadows.
It never occurred to me that shadows had colour. I just think of them as shadows.
Well, you could start asking yourself each day what the colour of any particular shadow is, because any shadow depends on the colour of the light. The best place to observe that is in the evening when the sun goes starting to go down and becomes yellower. And if it's shining on, if there are clouds, which there usually are, you will notice that the underside of the clouds are purple-grey. And that is because purple is the complementary colour of light. In other words, shadows always contain the complement of the colour of the light. So if you were in a disco and you had a pink spotlight shining on, let's say, a box, you would have green shadows.
I can see it now that I know what to look for.
Yes, but again, I use the analogy of music because, for instance, if someone were to tell you about a jazz piece and that there were three levels of rhythm, well, you might love the jazz piece, but until someone had pointed that out, then if someone pointed it out, you would say, oh yeah, there are three different rhythms going on there. And it's really just like that with colour.
Why don't people teach this all the time?
I don't know. In my perfect world, they would.
Catherine Boucher-Berg there talking to Eleanor Flegg, and Catherine's work can be seen at catherineboucherberg.com. Ventriloquism is a dead art, according to Monkey, who just happens to be the puppet sidekick of a ventriloquist, Nina Conti. But the funny thing is, if anybody's been proving that there's still puff in the vent act in 2015, it's Nina Conti, whose shining creativity is giving the art an unaccustomed depth while keeping things devastatingly, contagiously funny. Garode Farrelly sat down with Conti on her recent visit to Galway to hear how the daughter of actor Tom Conti left behind legit theatre for a career in throwing voices.
I always think there's a touch of magic to ventriloquism. A good ventriloquist makes the audience believe that the dummy on their hand is a living, breathing entertainer. But a great ventriloquist realises that the most powerful thing in the room is not their ability to breathe life into the puppet, but to harness the audience's belief. And it's that that brings the show to life.
Okay, come on, Monk, we're on. Do they know it's ventriloquism? Yeah, they do now. Do they know how I feel about it? No, I think it's a dead art. Come on, it's not.
I started because a theatre director called Ken Campbell gave me a Teach Yourself Ventriloquism kit, and it was a sort of a goad, really. It was a mischievous gift to, I don't know, subvert me and my acting ambitions. And I just tried it out really to prove to him that I wasn't the right muse for this. But in trying it out and watching a little film back that I'd taken of myself, I thought, that's really weird. Looks like there's two people in the room. And I knew at the time, obviously, it had just been me and I'd said all the words, but watching it back fooled myself. So then I just haven't stopped since then. That was about 15 years ago.
Did you think at the time that that would be something you would pursue?
Like, no.
Did you think it would just act and this would be your party trick?
Who would think they would pursue talking to a puppet one afternoon or, you know, just to see what that's like? To think that that would be my career for the next 15 years, I look back on that day, it's so seminal and bizarre. But no, I never thought. I thought I'd do it for maybe one show in the summer and then put it away, but it's still going.
To begin ventriloquism, performers need to master the art of forming a second pair of lips using the soft palate, which is as difficult as it sounds.
Bottle of gur. Bottle of gur.
And apparently there's even more to it than that.
It's a really specific skill. You have to do a lot of learning for one thing to even... It's like learning to talk before you start doing stand-up.
Yeah, it's a bit like that. Well, it's at the beginning, it feels so hard. What's so hard when you start is you're making the puppet talk and your face, even if your lips aren't moving, your face is reflecting the emotions of what the puppet's saying, just in your eyebrows and stuff, because you can't disassociate from what... To disassociate from what you're saying is... It's the opposite of what we've learned all our lives in trying to communicate. So to throw it a step behind as if you're only just hearing... It takes a while, and it's like rubbing your tummy and patting your head.
Because there were times definitely last night where I was almost convinced that Monk and you had spoken together.
Oh. But that's how it feels to me now, because I've been doing it so long. I've forgotten the mechanism of it. So it does sort of feel like Monkey says the things. When I remember a show, I'll like quote Monkey, like,
you know, as if he's a different character.
Yeah, just say, do you remember when Monkey said blah blah? And I think Monkey didn't say it, you said it, but in my memory, because I see his face saying it, I forget that I said it. Weird.
Nina's most recent show, In Your Face, is a big departure from her scripted comedy shows in that it is almost entirely improvised and is very much a collaboration with the audience. No pressure there, Nina.
I get people up from the audience and I put ventriloquist masks on them and then I make them talk and create the characters on stage live. But the key to the whole thing is remaining optimistic. And I have to remind myself sometimes mid-show, it's gonna be great. And if you just keep telling yourself this is gonna be great, you even say it. Even when the person you've got up is thinking, oh, they're not responding to the cues or it's just not really working, you just keep telling them they're fantastic. And everybody, like, has one thing, one or two things that just is their clown. That's their gag. It's really, it's quite a fascinating sort of experiment, I feel, what I'm doing. Also, the ventriloquism, I really do feel like that's second nature to the shows now. I mean, that's just the pen. To me, not... the main thing about it. I don't know, maybe it is really obviously that to everybody else, but to me it's much more to do with the audience or what we're saying rather than the fact that I'm not moving my mouth.
In her show, Nina lets the audience glimpse behind the curtain as she turns her audience into puppets live on stage. Though fans of her puppet Monk shouldn't despair, as he is still very much part of the show, though he wasn't available for this interview.
It's so weird to do Monkey's voice when he's not here. Why is it weird? Because you're not here. I am. I'm always here. No, you're not always here. I'm in your head all the time. No, not all the time. Well, I am now. Because I invited you. This is weird. It is weird. Monkey? Yeah. Go away. Okay. This is sad.
Was he the first puppet, Monk?
Yeah.
His voice is so perfect.
That's what you want, is when the voice suits the face, God, something just comes alive. But I've had puppets made or commissioned grand ideas, and then you can't get the voice for it. You think, oh my God, I can't bring it to life. I mean, it's the bravest show I've ever done, because you are throwing yourself open. And so you get someone up and you put the mask on them and you think, oh no, it's not working yet, is it? What should we, you know, let's try to let the audience in on that process. I think there's great rewards in it, but it is also quite scary.
Some say Nina Conti is responsible for reinventing ventriloquism as an art form. In her early routines, she would become the puppet or she would use the monkey's voice herself, and it was mind-blowing. In her documentary, Her Master's Voice, she talks about her frustration with the limits of ventriloquism. I was curious as to whether this improvised show meant that she was getting bored.
Rather than bored, I think I got braver. Like, I would dip my toe in the water of improvising and saying a few things to the audience. And then always after the show, they would have been my favourite bits. It did make my heart race a bit, and I would be a bit scared and thinking, oh, we're off piece now. Where are we,
yeah,
you know, how
yeah.
are we going to
get back in?
But then just realising, actually, no, those are the funny bits. Don't panic to get off them. Those are the bit. That is the stuff. The stuff that's happening now in the room is more exciting to participate in a way. I don't think that for all everybody. I mean, I love when you go and see someone who's written the hell out of a show and it's brilliantly crafted and all that. I mean, wow. That's probably where the pendulum will swing for me next. I think probably I will write something very, very meticulously afterwards.
Nina Conti there talking to Garode Farrelly, and Nina will be throwing her voice around Dublin's Vicar Street on November 27th. In what's either a case of fortuitous or terrible timing, Irish playwright Eva Gore Booth was the centre of attention at a series of events in UCC this week. So as the Abbey Theatre hunkered down against the flak, following its announcement of an almost all-male list of playwrights for its 1916 season, the Cork event celebrated an often overlooked woman playwright, with a programme including a reading of The Death of Fiona Mhair, a play written by Gore Booth from the heart of the Rising. Cathy Lee of UCD spoke to Rachel Andrews about Gore Booth, a poet, writer and labour activist whose death in 1926 was marked by obituaries in both the New York Times and the Times of London.
O wandering water, fallen from thy rest among the hills and many secret streams, what dream dost thou bear away to the west, where the Atlantic waits for all our dreams? Thy creeping footsteps fill the night with sound and silence, gliding through the windless tent, still as deep waters that flow underground, dark with the vision of a fierce event.
In that play, she used, as many writers, almost all writers, in fact, of that period who were writing for the theatre, they went back to the Celtic myths, with which people were familiar, audiences were familiar, and they wrote new versions of them. As the critic Richard Cave says, if you were faithful to the original material, your version of mythic stories tended to be very popular and to be recognised widely. If you departed from the original stories, then people got upset about that because these myths were being used as a way of defining Irish identity as against English identity as part of the nationalist struggle. And Eva was very much rewriting these myths in a completely feminist kind of way. So she was placing the women characters at the centre of the stories. I would argue, at any rate, that there are definite signs of a much more disturbing and unsettling symbolist tendency in her plays, which links her with very interesting developments in theatre in Europe at the beginning of the 20th century, at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. So she was really testing the limits of theatrical representation in a very fascinating way in her plays.
Is there then none of you will tell me the words of her whose swift end has broken my heart? Unfaithful and untrue, are you all slaves? Have I not then one friend?
She flung her arms out to the blue and cried, is this the triumph of Maeve? And shrieked and fell and lay so still, none knew when she died. O Queen, this is a grievous tale to tell.
Yea, and a grievous triumph.
It's absolutely exhilarating for me to have experienced the reading that took place yesterday night in Cork City Jail. To hear the text of the play being spoken by really very able actors, some professional actors, some student actors, with a beautiful musical accompaniment. And in that space as well, which is a very atmospheric space, it was very exciting to hear that. And to see the kind of dramatic skill that Gore Booth exercised in structuring the play and in structuring the language, which is very much a kind of Yeatsian symbolist use of language, which is incantation, repetition, huge musicality, which meant that the harp music that was playing during the performance added a really wonderful other dimension to the narrative of the play. Both sisters, Constance and Eva, are both problematic figures in terms of what Irish women were supposed to be doing in that period. They were supposed to be supporting men to fight the revolution, and neither sister was content with that role. And so therefore, to some extent, that explains, I think, why they have been written out of the history of the period, both politically and in a literary way in the case of Eva.
And 2016, I suppose, gives us the opportunity to revisit writers such as Eva Gore Booth. But yeah. I'm wondering with the, particularly the discussion about the Abbeys programme for 2016, where that leaves women writers, it doesn't feel like a very equal space.
Absolutely. That's very true. And being here on this particular weekend when this news about the Abbey programme for 1916 has just been announced, really one feels that there's been a huge opportunity missed here in the choices made for that programming, and that should this event have happened earlier and Abbey programmers, whoever they may be aware of it, that they might have reached some kind of consciousness of how exciting it would have been, or it would still be perhaps, to look at the work of Eva Gore Booth in relation to that celebration next year. After all, the National Theatre as symbolic of the theatre of the nation has a hugely important part to play in terms of what that consciousness is of a tradition. And there is a tradition of Irish women writers, and we need to celebrate it more.
She forsook the kind hearth of the world and the sweetness of things that are, to build up the pride of her soul on some lonely and perilous star.
She is hidden away from the twilight. Her secret is known to none. She has broken her faith with the wind and the sea. She is false to the sun.
Kathy Leaney there on the unsilenceable revolutionary playwright Eva Gore Booth. And with that wave from the barricades, we've come to the end of another Culture File Weekly. Come Monday, Culture File will begin a week of special programmes celebrating autumn in Italy. So next week's weekly will be an autumn in Italy special too, with a sprinkling of white truffle and a plan for the future of food. Till then, bye now.